While the questions come in, we already have a few good ones. I want to ask you about the Yale program that I've heard you mention before, where you study the truth claims of the Buddha, Jesus, Nietzsche, and allow students to really be confronted with their claims as truth claims on our life. Can you tell us a little more about that? Because it's a fascinating example in the academic world of what you're talking about.
Yeah, you may think of, say, Yale, and sometimes we at Yale think of ourselves as secular university. Again, I tend to think of Yale as a pluralistic university. And in such university, you may think that kind of normative claims of religions may be kind of pushed aside. I find that not to be the case, and especially at Yale, there's a long tradition of thinking and engaging truth claims of alternative worldviews. And what I do in this course is basically, in a sense, it's a way to train us or citizenry or students to reflect and deliberate about religions as if or precisely as once they do make truth claims. Generally, what happens about religions, you don't talk about religion, or you presume that religion is simply your preference. This is kind of what you've decided to do, and that's okay. And you like certain kind of food, I like certain other kind of food, and we're okay if we disagree on foods, but it's a matter of your taste rather than a matter of claims to truth that it has on you. Now, I think when that happens in the public debate, obviously something very significant gets lost. Because you can adjudicate taste if tastes clash. Then you only have to either vote against them, right? Or you have to fight. There's no other option. But if religions make actually truth claims, then there is an ability and possibility that we can engage those, learn something from each other, kind of adjust our perspectives, enrich our own understanding of that truth. So my sense is that what we are doing there in this course is actually training people for responsible citizenship and for something like hoped for deliberative democracy. I know that many other things stand in way of deliberative democracy, but certainly seeing religions as simply expressions of our taste is one of those things.
Very interesting question about our Bible, our First Fleet Bible here. Someone has written in, do you think that the Bible you are sharing the stage with could rightly be perceived as a symbol of Christianity's implication in colonialism? Is this not inappropriate in the context of a conference on Christianity in the public square?
Well, it's not just the Bible that's implicated in the Christianity's history of colonialism. Christianity is implicated, right? In Christianity's kind of colonial legacy. I think that may be for some people reason enough not to talk about Christianity in public sphere space at all. But what hasn't been implicated in the Western tradition in colonialism? Have not the great writers been implicated in colonialist project? Read Edward Said on this. Have not great political visions been implicated in colonialist project? Think of Karl Marx, think of Immanuel Kant and connection with I can run it down through the who's who in Western canon. Certainly Christianity has been implicated. My sense is that it's Christianity that has been too closely tied to the political power. It's a Christianity that has been too closely allied with the empire. And it's at the heart, I think, of Christian faith, as I think it is at the heart of world faiths, precisely to resist that kind of an implication. I think some people are very leery when religious, great religious faiths think in terms of universal terms, because any form of universalism is already seen as a kind of colonial by default. But I think there is something very salutary in universalism, and what's salutary about it, it is that religious universalism thematizes human beings qua human beings, which is to say that to each of them it grants exactly the same value. That is to say, that is a foundation then for a basically anti-colonial project that I think would have been more in line with the character of the Christian faith. I think also, notwithstanding the passages from the Old Testament, more in line with the Bible itself.
You mentioned just then, and you did on Q&A last night, that Christianity serves society best from the margins. And one questioner has picked you up on that and said, should we intentionally move there or wait to be pushed?
I think any Christianity that's think of itself at the center of the power has to a significant degree already betrayed itself. So I think wherever one finds oneself, there's kind of marginality in terms of ethical stance, in terms of loyalty, that's already at work in authentic faith. I cannot be at the center of the power, fully identified with the power, and serve the one God of all people. I will always be at a remove. My allegiance will always be conditional. The only allegiance that's not conditional is the allegiance to that one. And therefore, certain forms of marginality reside at the very center of power if Christians find themselves there.
That segues to the topic of religious violence. Often religion has at the center been violent. And one of the questioners asks about the work of William Kavanagh, who's written about the violence of religion, so-called, and the violence of democracy also. Mm. What is religion's role in violence, and what is religion's role in calling democratic violence to account?
Yeah, nation state has been, competes quite well, I think, with religion for violence. I think wins if you do the kind of body counts. One of my friends actually ordered a book called Body Count, and he had a sociologist and historian of societies do the comparative analysis, which of the religions, including their Marxism, has in its trail left the largest number of dead people. It's a kind of morbid endeavor.
but who wins or loses?
Well, that's an interesting question. In this book, and it's my very good friend who's a Muslim, Prince Ghazi of Jordan is the one who commissioned that book. Christians win, meaning most bodies are in Christian trail. Now, I'm not completely convinced, but even if we come second, right? are we going to be particularly proud of that as Christians, or third for that matter, or fourth? The difference might be 50 million up and down. Okay, each individual life matters, but if you've got 90 behind you already, a nation state, I think, has been deeply implicated in violence. I'm not sure, though, fully what to think of Kavanagh's work in terms of nation states. I'm partly persuaded by the work of Steven Pinkert, whom I have I don't know if you've seen this book. It's about 800-page tome called Better Angels of Our Nature. And he argues that violence has over the centuries declined. violence understood at least in kind of relative terms, kind of per capita violent incident in which involve homicide, have over the centuries from primitive societies until today have actually consistently declined. And he thinks that part of the reason is a kind of a much more benign violence of the nation state. Nation state self-imposition of kind of Leviathan, which controls, has a monopoly on violence. It reduces number of homicides, and he thinks that pacification of societies like Europe is part to be attributed to the emergence of nation state. Kavanaugh makes exactly opposite argument, and I'm not sure exactly how to adjudicate, though Pinkert has a good point, I think.
Someone asks, how ought a Christian politician and or a Muslim politician act in society as a politician?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure that I have very good advice, actually.
Last night on Q&A, you said a politician needs to learn to separate their religion from their politics.
Well, so for instance, you can take a judge. You can't make judgments on the basis of your personal convictions. You make judgments according to the laws of the land to a certain extent. I think politician has to do the same thing. And I think one of the central questions is to what degree in a particular setting a person thinks that the kind of political office that they might have would be in sync with the conscience, their own conscience, because politics exert kind of pressures to act in certain ways in accordance with the kind of demands of the political situation, and these are, I think, the wisdom judgments which have to be made. And I think there ought to be a point where politicians can say, "Sorry, I don't do that," even if the state requires. Just like, for instance, I think that I don't know how it is here, but in the United States, if you serve me, I'm kind of half pacifist or semi-pacifist, not quite fully. So take what I say in with that from that perspective. But I could never understand on any grounds, moral grounds, Christian grounds, how it is that a person can be conscripted or himself join or herself join the army and then by that very act commit himself or herself to wage all the wars which the army to which he has signed, for which he has signed up, wages. That seems abdicating one's own conscience to another institution, and it seems to be complete betrayal of the moral stance that one has. I cannot abdicate my moral responsibility to an army. I cannot abdicate my moral responsibility to a state. That would mean to have a state which is God rather than, or army which is God and not God who is God, right? And in that sense, I think politicians have to make, or those engaged in politics have to make difficult judgments. I may be more severe than some other folks are on this, but that's where I stand about it.
Someone makes the observation that, ironically, it's kind of the majority powerful, educated type of person that can make your argument here in the public and at Yale. But how are the oppressed, the poor, the minorities who don't really have a voice in the public square to speak up in this pluralistic world?
Yeah, those who have been silenced, those who don't even know that they can articulate their own vision, those who have internalized so much the state in which they find themselves that they don't even know that there is an alternative way of life, alternative possibility here. I think that's where speaking for somebody, listening to somebody, being with somebody, experiencing life from their vantage point comes in. I think sometimes those who are oppressed can have kind of alternative politics. I'm thinking of my upbringing. I think by all counts you'd consider us as having been oppressed, just that we didn't know that. And maybe that's because of this internalization of the state in which we were. But I think for us, then, Christian faith function as alternative politics. Now, I did my doctoral dissertation on Karl Marx, and I know what some of you are thinking. That's opiate for the people, right? You dream the dreams so that you can kind of stabilize your situation so that you can feel okay in just about what there is. And I'm sure that it sometimes functions this way, but it can also be a kind of imagining of an alternative world so that when circumstances become such that one can articulate a social vision, it gets to be also articulated so that you hold yourself beholden to something larger than your circumstances, and then you're actually able in a small scale and then large scale change what it is. And I think this nurturing of hope, no matter what circumstances, is absolutely fundamental.
In light of your thoughts on religion and conflict and violence and the idea of a pluralistic democracy, the importance of that, are we compelled, therefore, to fight for freedom of religion in other countries where this pluralistic democracy doesn't exist?
I think we should fight, which is not necessarily with machine guns, right? Not with bombers or whatever. I think often of 250 million persecuted Christians, that's a lot of folks. Other religions as well. And I think we have some responsibility for them. I think we have responsibility to struggle for concrete human beings, but also for institutions in other countries which would allow them to have a space in which they can breathe freely, articulate their own vision of good life, live that vision of good life to the good of others. Yeah, I think we have a social responsibility. That's part and parcel of loving our neighbors.
A hot topic in Australia at the moment is special religious education in state schools, not the private religious schools. And someone has asked what your ideas of pluralistic democracy might mean for the teaching of religion in schools with kids in primary school, so under 12-year-olds, and kids in high school.
You know, I think my argument would be kind of equal access. I think each country might have their own traditions, how they might do that, but I think it's impartiality of the state toward all religious and our religious perspectives. And therefore, I can imagine religion being taught, but then also other religions than just one particular being taught as well. There are varieties of alternatives are possible here.
But you're not a fan of comparative religion, the sort of supposedly impartial, objective approach to religion.
Well, I think we need information about religions, right? So I'm not opposed to this, but I don't think that's enough. I think what I'm trying to do at Yale is also essential for the well-being of our children, well-being of our society, to stimulate the discussion about what are the alternative ways to what is a pervasive way in which we think in what flourishing life consists. And I think it consists in basically fulfillment of our desires. And often these desires are relatively reduced to what comes to us from media. And interesting thing that I was not as much aware of it. How, for instance, three phenomena that we study, there are something that everybody, of course, is concerned about, which is sex, money, and power. But all three phenomena in contemporary culture have their own addictions, and very significant addictions. And you see something then in the dynamic of the desire which creates addictive character if the desire is not framed, trained in proper way. And I think all world faiths seek to shape and train the desire and expand the desire so that it doesn't stay limited to the flat plane of everyday reality and therefore issue in addictions. And I think training in normative dimensions of religious faiths would be important. I think that's also part of the reason for doing evangelism for those of us who are Christians.
Segues beautifully to the question someone has written in. Where does the Great Commission to go out and make disciples of all nations fit into this idea of a pluralistic democracy?
Fits really well.
Yes, I agree. Can you articulate that to others?
No, it seems to me like the definition of pluralistic democracy for me is that each of the alternative accounts of life worth living or of the good life has claim to truth. And therefore, every time I talk about Christian faith, it is implicitly a form of witness. If I talk about Christian faith as true, whether the situation is one of dialogue or the situation is one of proclamation, it is bearing witness. And I think the most fundamental stance of a way of pursuing or making good on the Great Commission is simply to bear witness. Bearing witness not to myself, bearing witness to something that is outside of myself, something that's larger than myself, and something that I consider to be true. In that sense, I think I expect Muslims to evangelize me. I expect Buddhists to evangelize me, and if they don't, I think, well, why not? Why would you have this that you consider to be true, and I sit here, and you're just content to twiddle with your thumbs and won't tell me? Why is it that what should I do with my desires so that I can be liberated? That's a great conversation to have and to go back and forth, and I might be enriched.
Yes, because when you use the term pluralism or pluralistic democracy, you don't mean the kind of banal pluralism that says all religions are equally true in every respect. You mean something else that I think you have now explained.
Well, and basically what I mean, the adjective political pluralism is really important. Religious exclusivism, this was the whole point of the argument, that religious exclusivists, namely those who claim that their religions are true, which is majority of religious people, religious exclusivists can be, and I think ought to be, political pluralists. It's not relativism at all. It's just allowing or creating political order which respects equally all citizens, no matter what their exclusivistic positions with regard to truth are.
It's a fascinating concept. I won't end on the brilliant question here, where did you get your socks? I will end on
my wife. It's all Jessica's doing.
I will ask you one question to end. You've talked about this course you do at Yale where they study Buddha, they study Nietzsche, they study Jesus. Can I press you? I know you don't like talking about too much about the things that are unique to faith, but I want to push you a little bit to say, what do you hope your students feel after studying the Buddha, after studying Nietzsche, and then studying Jesus? Not as a conglomerate, not the one thing they feel, but the thing they might feel specially as a result of studying these as individual teachers.
Well, I'm immensely attracted to Jesus. Not just attracted, but I think that his teaching and more his person is true. So without wanting to push my students, it's a pluralistic situation that I, as a teacher, want to respect. But if I were to step back from my role as a teacher, and kind of observe what's happening, I would say, yeah, I want my students to discover the beauty of who Jesus Christ is. I don't like to talk about uniqueness, or rather, I would say that there is nothing particularly significant in the fact of uniqueness, but I think that there are some unique elements in the Christian faith. I myself find kind of the idea that God's love is, or at the heart of the whole reality lies this, as Luther puts it, burning furnace of love, which is in absolutely no way reactive. It doesn't respond to what it finds, so that it loves some but not others, or that the measure of love is measured by the virtue of the object that is before him, but rather is indiscriminate. And this idea of indiscriminate divine love, which I think runs through the whole of the edifice of the Christian faith and is embodied, I think, in Jesus, I think that's, to me, one of the most attractive ideas around. I was talking during lunch here how we emphasize these days authenticity. Authenticity is so important to us. And yet we are just about the least authentic people on the planet, right? Or in history, in some ways. Because we craft ourselves all the time. There cannot be a moment of our lives where we kind of simply are. You know, I iron my pocket handkerchief, I put the red socks, you know, I kind of craft image to come to speak to you. It starts from the way when we get up to whatever else we do, whoever we encounter, we kind of edit, we present ourselves, we sell ourselves, and especially in the kind of market-driven economy where you constantly need to kind of succeed, you're constantly doing that. And then comes this extraordinary message, said, you don't need to do any of that stuff. You are loved just because you are you. What can be more liberating than that? And it's not kind of liberating. So what I love about Christian faith is that it isn't simply a way of life. It doesn't tell you simply what you need to do. It doesn't tell you primarily what you need to do. It, in a sense, tells you who you are. And that's, to me, extraordinary. I hope if my students don't even kind of an encounter of Jesus in any way move toward Jesus, that they would discover the beauty of that idea and consider it.
I have no idea if Richard Johnson would have followed anything you said tonight, but I suspect he would have recognized a spirit, generous, thoughtful, there for the public good in what you've brought us tonight. And for that, I say thank you, Miroslav Volf.
Thank you, John.